Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Thursday, August 20. The story, Army grapples with higher cadet standards after yanking memo. The Army is eyeing new minimum academic standards for college students in the Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC, but not without some internal drama. The service branch issued fresh standards earlier this month, only to pull them days later amid differing opinions and an apparent lack of consultation with some senior leaders. Under the withdrawn standards, incoming ROTC cadets would have to meet one of the three academic benchmarks, score 20 on the ACT, a 1,000 on the SAT, or test in the 50th percentile on the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, or ASVAB, a standardized test on science, math, and language. The Army must cultivate intelligent and adaptive officers to build a lethal and ready Army, prepared to deter, fight, and win our nation's wars. The strength of our officer corps is the strength of our Army, Jules J. Hurst III, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower and Reserve Affairs, wrote in an internal August 5 memo, which was obtained by The Hill. The Army requires enlisted soldiers to score 110 on the ASVAB line scores to participate in Officer Candidate School, which trains civilians and enlisted personnel to gain a commission as officers in the armed forces. Line scores are a combination of subtests in the ASVAB that qualify candidates for certain career tracks in the military. No equivalent standards exist for cadets to contract into the Army Senior Reserve Officer Training Corps, or SROTC, Hurst said in the internal document. 2 days after signing the memo, Hurst was confirmed by the Senate as the Pentagon comptroller. The new requirement was set to take effect in January next year. Starting January 1, 2027, all students seeking to contract into SROTC must get a 110 on the ASVAB or provide proof that they met or exceeded prescribed scores on the SAT and ACT, the internal document said. SROTC cadets already under contract are excluded from this requirement. This policy will only apply to undergraduate students, the memo's text said. Adding the U.S. Army Cadet Command would revisit the standards annually. Days later, the memo was rescinded. Secretary of the Army Mike Obadell said it requires further staffing and analysis, according to an internal August 12 memo, which was reviewed by The Hill. The New York Post reported on Friday that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was angry that the memo was rescinded. Hegseth's office referred The Hill to the Army. The rescission prompted gripes among some defense officials who privately argue the service branch should have minimum standards in line with Hegseth's push to raise standards for military officers, which has also included a focus on fitness and grooming. The Army indicated that imposing standards is not dead, but would require more input from senior leadership. The Army is in lockstep with Secretary Hegseth and the President's direction regarding military standards and readiness, an Army spokesperson said. In a statement to The Hill, the Army is evaluating proposed changes to ROTC cassette standards for review by appropriate senior leaders and approval by the Secretary of the Army, Dan Driscoll, and the Acting Chief of Staff of the Army, General Christopher Lanev. When reached for comment, the U.S. Army Recruiting Command said it had nothing further to add. Will Thibault, an Army veteran and now a director of the American Military Project at the Center for the American Way of Life at the Claremont Institute, said it is a really positive sign. The Army is considering establishing modest minimum standards for standardized tests that reinforce existing ROTC evaluation metrics. The minimum standards outlined in the now rescinded policy are below national averages, and we should expect more from those who will lead Americans in military service. I take the Army at their word that the step to rescind those standards is a step to double-check the timing and specific metrics of the policy, Thibault told The Hill on Wednesday. Privately, some within the Pentagon saw the confusion around the August 5 memo as evidence of disorder within the service branch, but others said Army leadership was not clued in, noting that Hearst is a Hegseth ally. Not all of the right Army leaders, including Driscoll, were given a chance to weigh in on standards in the memo before it was issued to U.S. officials familiar with the deliberations, who spoke on condition of anonymity, told The Hill. Part of the discussion was if the standards were high enough, one U.S. official said, adding there is a desire within the service branch to make standards more stringent. Leniev, who is close with Hegseth and is nominated to be the next Army Chief of Staff, was not satisfied with the standards outlined in the August 5 memo, a second U.S. official told The Hill. Leniev's spokesperson declined to comment and referred The Hill to the Army. Hearst, through a spokesperson, declined to comment, referring The Hill to the Army. Backers of the August 5 memo say cadets should show intellectual agility before becoming officers. Others question if ACTs and SATs are reliable measures to assess an officer's future performance. The SAT has not historically been a measure that is predeterminative of officer performance and would serve to exclude candidates that would benefit from Army training, and the Army would benefit from developing the talent, a former senior defense official granted anonymity to speak candidly told The Hill on Wednesday. Students in ROTC, upon completion of the program, can become second lieutenants in the U.S. Army Reserve, Army National Guard, and Army. Current Army rules already include academic, physical, and other requirements. To secure an ROTC scholarship, applicants need to meet physical standards, have a minimum of 2.5 unweighted high school GPA, and have to take the SAT or ACT, but no minimum score is required. But most cadets are not on scholarships, and the new standards would cover all Army SROTC enrollees. In 2024, just over a third of ROTC cadets were on scholarships. The story is the memo column. Angie Nixon's shock Florida win gives fresh boost and a new test for the left. The left of the Democratic Party scored its biggest upset of the year on Tuesday, and it did so in Florida, a state that is usually inhospitable territory for anything adjacent to socialism. State Representative Angie Nixon, Democrat, beat Alexander Vindman handily in the Democrats' U.S. Senate primary. Nixon, a progressive lawmaker and organizer who recently joined the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, beat Vindman by more than 12 points, despite suffering from a 16-1 fundraising disadvantage. Nixon found success running largely on economic issues. She supports Medicare for all, free child care, and a significant increase in the minimum wage. Notably, those are all policies that poll strongly among Democrats at large and by and large among the broader population. Vindman had been best known as a central witness in President Trump's first impeachment. On Wednesday, Trump gloated about Vindman's defeat, the most gratifying loss last night, while also deriding Nixon's chances in the general election. She is, the president insisted, a radical left lunatic who would go down to certain defeat in November against Senator Ashley Moody, Republican of Florida. Moody was appointed to the Senate by Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, as a replacement for Marco Rubio, who left the upper chamber to become Trump's Secretary of State. Democrats naturally don't see Nixon either as a lunatic or as one who is doomed to defeat, but they do acknowledge that she will have an uphill climb to win the general election, even at a time when Trump's approval ratings are bumping around close to all-time lows. Florida, having been a key battleground for years, has become safer Republican territory. No Democrat has carried it at the presidential level since former President Obama. Rubio won his 2022 re-election fight for the Senate by 16 points, and Senator Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, won re-election 2 years later by 13 points. Steve Shale, a Democratic strategist who was the Florida state director in Obama's 2008 victory, said that either Nixon or Vindman would face a tough path to get to 50% in November. Asked if he believed the gradient was even steeper for Nixon, Shale said he could argue the case either way. The pro-Nixon argument, he said, is that she has the capacity to energize voters, especially young progressives, and the African-American community. Notably, Nixon was victorious in Tuesday's primary in low-income areas and in areas with large black populations, a rebuke of sorts to those who argue that the current leftist energy is largely confined to affluent young white people. On the other hand, Shale noted, Nixon faces real obstacles in the increasingly Republican state. The basic partisan math, he said, requires Democratic candidates to peel off a significant number of voters who normally back the GOP if they are to have any real chance of victory. The challenge for Angie is, who are those voters that voted for Trump and voted for Rubio and are going to vote for Republican state legislators who are also going to vote for Angie Nixon, he said. Defenders of Nixon note that her focus on economic issues plainly resonated at least in the primary. They say she should not be underestimated in the general election. Some also note that Florida's increasingly red hue can obscure some of its political complexity. For example, in 2020, Trump carried the state even while losing the national election to former President Biden. Yet on the same day, Florida voters overwhelmingly passed an amendment increasing the minimum wage. Nixon is seeking to capitalize on economic discontent and broad anti-establishment sentiment much more than an ardor for abstract socialist ideals. In a TikTok video back in January, she cast herself as a fighter for working Americans who have suffered under the status quo. Florida, we have a problem. Corrupt politicians in D.C. are working for greedy corporations instead of fighting for the rest of us, Nixon began. Enough is enough. Something has to change. That's the kind of message that has plainly resonated in other Democratic primaries this year, as incumbents have fallen to leftist challengers from New York to Colorado. Florida Democratic strategist Jackson McMillan was one of the few to argue before Tuesday's primary that Nixon had a real chance of winning. He told this column that the media focus on DSA was somewhat beside the point, especially given how recently Nixon had affiliated herself with the organization. Speaking of her rise and that of similar candidates elsewhere, McMillan said it gets a lot of clicks to say the rise of DSA, but I think they are mostly just offering solutions that the Democrats refuse to commit to. McMillan cited Medicare for All as one example, describing himself as a capitalist and business owner who is frustrated by the high cost of medical insurance for himself and his employees. Politically, he sees the appeal of candidates like Nixon as having less to do with doctrinaire socialism than with a reaction against corporations and other moneyed interests failing to honor the social contract. Others in the party, however, note the particular challenges for candidates of the left in Florida. The state is home to sizable communities of Cuban Americans, Venezuelan Americans, and Nicaraguan Americans, many of whose family histories are characterized by memories of personal suffering at the hands of Marxist-inspired strongmen. Fernand Amandi, a Democratic pollster in Florida who is Cuban American, was asked about the difficulties in the state for explicitly socialist candidates. "It's not difficult," he responded, "it's a non-starter." But Amandi argued that Nixon doesn't fit so easily in the DSA box because of her history outside of the group, her lengthy record as an organizer, and the trust she has built up with many Democratic voters over the years. "I don't think there's an appetite for the DSA in Florida or socialism," he said. But having said that, Angie Nixon is a longtime party stalwart who is a talented campaigner and who centered her message around the cost of living and economic concerns. Those are by far the biggest issues in Florida. To be sure, victory in Florida may ultimately prove beyond Nixon. But if that is the outcome, it will be harder for centrists to say she has lost a race a more moderate Democrat would have won. Florida is very different in its political complexion than Michigan, where Democratic nominee Abdul El-Sayed offers a tidy test case whether leftist candidates can win in battleground states. For all the challenges, Nixon is talking up her chances. "I've unseated incumbents before. I've been outspent 5-1, she told MS Now's Morning Joe on Wednesday. "Ashley Moody will be calling me senator in November." The story: young Democrats eye Congress with affordability at the top of their agenda. A new generation of young progressive Democrats could enter Congress next year with a deeply personal connection to the economic issues at the center of their campaigns and a desire to make those policy items a bigger part of the party's agenda. For many of these potential lawmakers, the inability to afford a house and rising health care costs are some of the top issues that have shaped their own lives and those of their peers. That firsthand experience, they argue, has given younger Democrats a different sense of urgency around challenges that have become increasingly difficult for their generation to navigate. "I'm a millennial. Many of the colleagues that are running right now and being elected across the country right now are millennials," said 36-year-old Claire Valdez, the Democratic nominee running to represent New York's 7th Congressional District. "We have seen our futures foreclosed upon us. You know, we can't imagine having children or buying houses or retiring in the future. And that's a kind of like frustration and dissatisfaction among young people all over the country that needs to be heard. And that needs to be heard in the halls of power," she added. "But that mandate could run up against the realities of Congress, where seniority relationships and institutional knowledge still carry considerable weight. That could create an early test for both the incoming lawmakers and Democratic leadership. Younger members will have to learn to navigate an institution where policy expertise and procedural rules matter, while party leaders will have to decide how much influence to give a new generation eager to make its mark. I think the younger members are going to come in and try to change Congress, and the older members are going to have the perspective of come in and do not let the Congress change you," said Democratic strategist Antoine Seawright. "And I think patience are going to be the two, and process are going to be the three critical things. I think that in this environment, they're going to have to learn that you need 218, 217 other people to agree with you in order to move a piece of legislation." The push for generational change has been reflected in a string of Democratic primary victories by younger candidates in recent weeks. This includes 32-year-old Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier defeating Representative Adriano Espalot, Democrat of New York. In New York's 13th Congressional District primary, 31-year-old Angela Gonzalez-Torres winning the Democratic nomination in California's 34th Congressional District, and 29-year-old Malat Quiros ousting 15-term incumbent Representative Diana DeGette, Democrat of Colorado in Colorado's 1st Congressional District primary, among others. Like Valdez, these candidates have shown little hesitation in making the high cost of living a key part of their campaigns, arguing that Washington has done very little to address the issue. Some of the policies they've advocated for include universal health care and child care, stronger worker protections, fair wages, and expanded housing vouchers. Asked how aggressively she thinks Democrats should stand up to the Trump administration on these issues, Valdez said, "I think we need to be as aggressive as possible. We need to be using every single tool in our toolbox, even if we don't have, you know, a Democratic trifecta. We need to be demonstrating to our constituents, the American public, that we are fighting back and we're setting ourselves up for, you know, in a couple of years when, you know, hopefully we have a Democratic president and we can start moving a lot of the priorities forward that will actually transform American life," she said. But that push for a more aggressive approach could clash with moderate and senior members of the caucus who have greater experience navigating the legislative process and may favor a more measured strategy aimed at winning Republican support and avoiding an overly partisan path forward. Even so, Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, 71, said he expects young progressive Democrats, moderates, and senior members of the caucus to find common ground on a range of issues, including affordability. He said he's got a bill to regulate the price of all drugs that he hopes incoming freshmen will co-sponsor. I'm a member of both the Progressive and the New Dems, and I think New Dems want to bring prices down. I think Progressives want to bring prices down, and I think the whole country wants us to bring prices down. So whether it's allowing Americans to pay an awful lot less at the pump because we produce more oil than we consume, or whether it's to have Americans pay European prices for pharmaceuticals, there's a lot we could do to lower prices, Sherman argued. He added that he thinks if Democrats win back the House, they will likely operate on a razor-thin margin. The one thing they have to do is learn to passionately disagree in the private caucus meeting and then come out and vote as a unified bloc on the floor of the House, Sherman said. That's something Democrats didn't have to learn in 2024 because we're not in the majority. Although even then we have been, you know, even the minority has a reason to. We have voted with a level of loyalty and consistency that is way beyond what I saw 20 years ago. So I think the views we express privately may be diverse. Even the views we express to the press may be diverse, but our votes have got to be unified, he added. Representative Emanuel Cleaver, Democrat of Missouri, 81, said there will always be standout freshmen who bring charisma and quickly rise through the ranks, earning the attention of the broader Democratic caucus. He added that incorporating the voices of those emerging leaders and the ideas they bring to the table will be key next year if Democrats win back the majority. I'm glad we have new people, and some of them are going to, you know, probably not want to wait. You know, they may want to just step in on the first day and, you know, want to take some leadership. And I think we have to be very, very understanding of their impatience and not put it down, Cleaver said. The story: GOP trails Democrats by 8 points on congressional ballot in new poll. Republicans are trailing Democrats by about 8 points on a generic congressional ballot, according to a new poll from Emerson College and The Hill. In the survey, 50.7% said they would back a Democrat if the midterm elections were that day, and 43% said that they would back a Republican, with 6.3% unsure. The poll comes amid rocky political territory for the GOP as they head into this year's midterms. Republicans are facing President Trump's slumping approval rating, an unpopular Iran war, and concerns about the economy. According to a polling average from Decision Desk HQ, Trump's approval rating was 40.4% on Wednesday afternoon, with his disapproval rating at 56.3%. On Wednesday, former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, said he was worried about the GOP's chances of holding on to control of Congress in the wake of the midterms. I'm worried that I'm not seeing the clear message from Republicans. What is the plan of why you should stay in the majority? McCarthy told Fox News' Dana Perino. The former speaker questioned what Republicans' economic plan is going into next year and what the party's latest victories have been as examples. He said that some states' elections worried him. The Emerson College and The Hill poll took place from August 16 to 17, featuring 1,000 likely voters and plus or minus 3 percentage points as its credibility interval. The story: Rubio outperforms Vance in hypothetical 2028 matchups. Secretary of State Marco Rubio performed slightly better than Vice President Vance in multiple hypothetical 2028 presidential matchups against Democratic candidates, according to a new poll. The Emerson College and The Hill survey found that in 5 matchups against Democrats, Rubio outperformed Vance in all but one, with former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg holding a 5-point edge against both Republicans, while Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, and California Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, both had 5-point leads over Vance. Their respective advantage over Rubio was 3 and 2 points. Former Vice President Kamala Harris, meanwhile, held a 49-45 edge over Vance, but Rubio flipped the script and led Harris by 5 points. Progressive Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, trailed Vance by 2 points and Rubio by 5 points. Ocasio-Cortez was the only candidate to lose to both Republicans. At least 6% of the 1,000 respondents were undecided in every matchup, with as many as 11% undecided in a hypothetical bout between Vance and Ocasio-Cortez. The Emerson College and the Hill survey had a margin of error of 3 percentage points. Neither Vance nor Rubio have said publicly whether they will run for president in 2028, although they are the consensus top two in recent polls of likely GOP voters. The Secretary of State, who finished third in the 2016 GOP primary behind President Trump and Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, told Vanity Fair last year he will defer to the vice president if he seeks the GOP nomination. Vance said in June he will discuss a presidential run with his wife, Second Lady Usha Vance, after the November midterms. Usha Vance gave birth in July to the couple's fourth child. The way I make decisions is I try to not to make them until I absolutely must, the vice president told Robert Costa on CBS Sunday Morning. The 2028 GOP primary will be the first without Trump on the ballot since 2012, while the president has not weighed in publicly on his preference between Vance and Rubio. The Washington Post reported earlier this month he recently told donors in the Oval Office, "At the end of the day, we need to elect J.D." In response to that report, Trump said, "While Vance is great, and it is way too early to even be thinking about that." The president has also mentioned a Vance-Rubio ticket for 2028. In June, he said the populist Vance and the traditionally conservative Rubio would make a great team. "I don't know how you beat them if they're together," he told Miranda Devine on an episode of the New York Post's Pod Force One. The story: young Democrats eye Congress with affordability at the top of their agenda. A new generation of young progressive Democrats could enter Congress next year with a deeply personal connection to the economic issues at the center of their campaigns and a desire to make those policy items a bigger part of the party's agenda. For many of these potential lawmakers, the inability to afford a house and rising health care costs are some of the top issues that have shaped their own lives and those of their peers. That firsthand experience, they argue, has given younger Democrats a different sense of urgency around challenges that have become increasingly difficult for their generation to navigate. "I'm a millennial. Many of the colleagues that are running right now and being elected across the country right now are millennials," said 36-year-old Claire Valdez, the Democratic nominee running to represent New York's 7th Congressional District. "We have seen our futures foreclosed upon us. You know, we can't imagine having children or buying houses or retiring in the future. And that's a kind of like frustration and dissatisfaction among young people all over the country that needs to be heard. That needs to be heard in the halls of power," she added. "But that mandate could run up against the realities of Congress, where seniority and relationships and institutional knowledge still carry considerable weight. That could create an early test for both the incoming lawmakers and Democratic leadership. Younger members will have to learn to navigate an institution where policy expertise and procedural rules matter, while the party leaders will have to decide how much influence to give a new generation eager to make its mark. I think the younger members are going to come in and try to change Congress, and the older members are going to have the perspective of come in and do not let the Congress change you," said Democratic strategist Antoine Seawright. "And I think perspective, patience are going to be the two, and process are going to be the three critical things. I think that in this environment, they're going to have to learn that you need 218, 217 other people to agree with you in order to move a piece of legislation." The push for generational change has been reflected in a string of Democratic primary victories by younger candidates in recent weeks. This includes 32-year-old Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier defeating Representative Adriano Espaillat, Democrat of New York in New York's 13th Congressional District primary. 31-year-old Angela Gonzalez-Torres, winning the Democratic nomination in California's 34th congressional district, and 29-year-old Malat Quiros, ousting 15-term incumbent Representative Diana DeGette, Democrat of Colorado, in Colorado's first congressional district primary, among others. Like Valdez, these candidates have shown little hesitation in making the high cost of living a key part of their campaigns, arguing that Washington has done very little to address the issue. Some of the policies they've advocated for include universal health care and child care, stronger worker protections, fair wages, and expanded housing vouchers. Asked how aggressively she thinks Democrats should stand up to the Trump administration on these issues, Valdez said, "I think we need to be as aggressive as possible. We need to be using every single tool in our toolbox, even if we don't have, you know, a Democratic trifecta. We need to be demonstrating to our constituents, the American public, that we are fighting back and we're setting ourselves up for, you know, in a couple of years when, you know, hopefully we have a Democratic president and we can start moving a lot of the priorities forward that will actually transform American life," she said. But that push for a more aggressive approach could clash with moderate and senior members of the caucus who have greater experience navigating the legislative process and may favor a more measured strategy aimed at winning Republican support and avoiding an overly partisan path forward. Even so, Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, 71, said he expects young progressive Democrats, moderates, and senior members of the caucus to find common ground on a range of issues, including affordability. He said he's got a bill to regulate the price of all drugs that he hopes incoming freshmen will co-sponsor. "I'm a member of both the Progressive and the New Dems, and I think New Dems want to bring prices down. I think progressives want to bring prices down, and I think the whole country wants us to bring prices down. So whether it's allowing Americans to pay an awful lot less at the pump because we produce more oil than we consume, or whether it's to have Americans pay European prices for pharmaceuticals, there's a lot we could do to lower prices," Sherman argued. He added that he thinks if Democrats win back the House, they will likely operate on a razor-thin margin. "The one thing they have to do is to learn to passionately disagree in the private caucus meeting and then come out and vote as a unified block on the floor of the House," Sherman said. "That's something Democrats didn't have to learn in 2024 because we're not in the majority. Although even then we have been, you know, even if the minority has a reason to, we have voted with a level of loyalty and consistency that is way beyond what I saw 20 years ago. So I think the views we express privately may be diverse. Even the views we express to the press may be diverse, but our votes have got to be unified," he added. Representative Emanuel Cleaver, the second, a Democrat of Missouri, 81, said there will always be standout freshmen who bring charisma and quickly rise through the ranks, earning the attention of the broader Democratic caucus. He added that incorporating the voices of those emerging leaders and the ideas they bring to the table will be key next year if Democrats win back the majority. "I'm glad we have new people, and some of them are going to, you know, probably not to want to wait. You know, they may want to just step right in on the first day and, you know, want to take some leadership. And I think we have to be very, very understanding of their impatience and not put it down," Cleaver said. The story: bond markets rattle economy, forcing controversial buyback band-aid. The U.S. bond market is raising alarm bells for the economy, forcing the Trump administration to take emergency measures to ease the immediate impact on American pocketbooks. Long-term borrowing costs hit their highest levels across the world on Tuesday, with the cost for the U.S. government to borrow money reaching its highest rate in nearly two decades. Experts say the unpredictability surrounding the Iran war, President Trump's erratic trade policies, massive spending on artificial intelligence, and the soaring national debt are all contributing to the choppy economic waters. "One explanation is uncertainty," said Benjamin Shabbat, an adjunct associate professor at Northwestern University and a former senior policy advisor at the Federal Reserve. We have a new Fed chair. We have an FOMC, or Federal Open Market Committee, that looks legitimately divided about what the proper policy path is, and that's largely driven by uncertainty about the economy, he said. The yield on the 30-year Treasury bond surpassed 5.3% on Tuesday, marking the highest yield since April 2007, mere months before the start of a financial crisis that upended the global economy in the late 2000s. The 30-year bond yield ticked down to 5.285% at the close of business on Tuesday and has since dipped to nearly 5.2% as of Wednesday afternoon. The yield on the 30-year bond has not closed at under 5% since July 6. The decline in bond yields on Wednesday came after the Treasury Department said it will double the maximum amount of the country's long-term debt it can buy back. The increase from $2 billion to $4 billion per operation will be in effect from September 9 through at least November 4. The Treasury typically conducts so-called liquidity support buyback operations once or twice a week. The bond reaction to me signals that they are finally paying attention, said John Deal, managing director in the capital markets advisory practice at investment bank Post Oak Group. The Treasury Department is finally saying, okay, this is something that does indeed have stiff consequences if we get it wrong and it needs to be responded to, he continued. Markets rallied in response to the move, seeing bond yields plunge and the prices of gold and silver rise. However, Joel Griffith, a senior fellow at former Vice President Mike Pence's think tank, Advancing American Freedom, warned the move by the Treasury is worse than a Band-Aid. We're artificially manipulating those lower interest rates. We can temporarily get a reprieve in the lower rates by doing what the Treasury is doing, borrowing short-term debt and using the proceeds to buy back the long-term debt. But all that does in reality is just pump up asset prices, Griffith told The Hill. This does nothing to help typical families. It does nothing to help small businesses that are going to continue to bear the consequences of what is driving that long-term rate. They are addressing the symptom rather than the problem, he continued. David Cass, a former financial professor at the University of Maryland, equated the Treasury's move to quantitative easing, the practice of the Federal Reserve buying assets to inject more money into the economy and eventually boost demand. The move deployed during the Obama administration is intended to make the business environment a little more attractive for investors, Cass told The Hill. The effect of doing this would be to lower the 10-year Treasury yield, which would have in this case a small but positive impact on lowering costs, he said, noting that it should lower the cost of a 30-year mortgage or other consumer loans. Griffith argued the market rate should be allowed to reflect the reality that Democrats and Republicans are not addressing the problems. The hope would be that at some point this would actually push political leaders into making the hard decisions, he said. It's far better for us to deal with some economic pain now in hopes that we can address these long-term problems rather than continue to kick the can down the road, which is basically what the Treasury is doing this morning. One contributing factor to increasing bond yields, experts have noted, is the rise in U.S. government spending since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The national debt surpassed $40 trillion on Monday, roughly $16.5 trillion higher than where it stood on March 2020. The Iran war has only further ballooned the debt, analysts at the Center for Strategic and International Studies estimated in June that the Middle East conflict has cost the federal government between $35.2 billion and $42.5 billion, and the administration has sought tens of billions of dollars in additional funding from Congress. The asset markets tend to look forward. There's a lot of uncertainty with what's going on in Iran. That situation could linger or continue for some time, Cass remarked, noting the impact the war dragging on would have on oil prices, which will further squeeze Americans' finances. Trump downplayed concerns over the bond market and called for the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates during a meeting with cryptocurrency executives at the White House on Wednesday. No, I don't think so, Trump said when asked if Americans should be concerned about the volatility in the bond market. Our country is doing so well despite interest rates, he continued, calling interest rates artificially high. They raise them for no reason, and you can't go out to the market when you have a Fed that's raising interest rates. You can't say, I want to pay 3 points less than what the Fed says you're supposed to be paying, the president said. Some economic officials don't appear to be on the same page with the president. Multiple Federal Reserve officials appear to hint at increasing interest rates last month during a meeting between the FOMC and the Fed's Board of Governors, with attendees arguing that policy tightening would likely be necessary if inflation did not decline. A few of the participants who favored raising the target range for the federal funds rate at this meeting judged that doing so would likely help forestall the need for a steeper and potentially more costly sequence of tightening moves at a later stage, the meeting's minutes said. Annual inflation was 3.4% in July, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, well above the Fed's 2% target rate. The central bank, though, relies on the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which the Bureau of Economic Analysis will release for July next Wednesday. They should allow interest rates to go down. When you announce good numbers, you shouldn't drive them up, Trump said on Wednesday, referring to the FOMC. They keep thinking that will drive them up to stop inflation, because success in growth does not cause inflation. Other things cause inflation. The story: GOP trails Democrats by 8 points on congressional ballot in new poll. Republicans are trailing Democrats by about 8 points on a generic congressional ballot, according to a new poll from Emerson College and The Hill. In the survey, 50.7% said they would back a Democrat if the midterm elections were that day, and 43% said they would back a Republican, with 6.3% unsure. The poll comes amid rocky political territory for the GOP as they head into this year's midterms. Republicans are facing President Trump's slumping approval rating, an unpopular Iran war, and concerns about the economy. According to a polling average from Decision Desk HQ, Trump's approval rating was 40.4% on Wednesday afternoon, with his disapproval rating at 56.3%. On Wednesday, former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, said he was worried about the GOP's chances of holding on to control of Congress in the wake of the midterms. I'm worried that I'm not seeing the clear message from Republicans. What is the plan of why you should stay in the majority? McCarthy told Fox News' Dana Perino. The former speaker questioned what Republicans' economic plan is going into next year and what the party's latest victories have been as examples. He said that some states' elections worried him. The Emerson College and The Hill poll took place from August 16 to 17, featuring 1,000 likely voters and plus or minus 3 percentage points as its credibility interval. The story: Trump announces most crushing economic operation ever against Iran. President Trump announced Wednesday evening the most crushing economic operation ever against Iran amid negotiations to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, a major oil trading waterway that has been effectively closed since early March. This will be economic warfare and isolation on an unprecedented scale, the president wrote on Truth Social. Trump said any nation that works to provide any type of lifeline to Iran will be hit with tremendous economic consequences from the U.S., oil smuggling, swap lines, cash transfers, exchange houses, ship registries, front companies. It all needs to stop now. You know who you are, the president wrote. This will be an economic D-Day, and we need all of our allies to stand with the United States of America to isolate and defeat the Iran threat, Trump continued. The president's announcement follows Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's warning last week that the U.S. would seek to ramp up economic pressure on Tehran to reopen the critical waterway. On Thursday, Bessent told Newsmax's Rob Schmidt Tonight that Trump ordered the department to apply maximum pressure to the Iranian regime. It will be a combination of economic isolation, like the world has never seen before, and the continued blockade in the Strait of Hormuz that will keep anything from going in or out of the Iranian ports, he told Newsmax. Trump has telegraphed that he would unleash economic warfare against Iran by intensifying sanctions and continuing to enforce the U.S. naval blockade in the Arabian Sea, blocking vessels from departing Iranian ports. Trump's announcement came a day after the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, announced that the Gulf nation would cut off trade with Iran after Tehran's forces fired two missiles at the country. The president has also lashed out at Oman earlier this week, threatening to bomb the blank out of them if Muscat gets in the way amid talks to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Traffic in the waterway has gone up slightly, with 12 and 10 successful ship crossings on Monday and Tuesday, respectively, according to ship tracking firm Kepler. But the figures are still far below pre-war levels. Trump also announced last week that he would declare the strait a U.S. territory. The president did not expand on how he would achieve this goal, which he signaled again this week, considering Oman's and Iran's shared jurisdiction over this waterway. The story: U.S. Air Force plane turns back from Antarctica after Russian missile threat. A U.S. Air Force plane heading from New Zealand to Antarctica was forced to turn around Tuesday due to a potentially hazardous space activity warning. The American C-17 Globemaster aircraft, using call sign ICE-28, initially took off from Christchurch, New Zealand, around 9 a.m. local time, but returned back to Christchurch less than 3 hours later due to a Notice to Airmen, or NOTAM, sent by New Zealand's Civil Aviation Authority, or CAA. A spokesperson from CAA told The Hill Tuesday that it was made aware of a potentially hazardous activity by Russia's State Air Traffic Management Corporation, resulting in the issuance of a NOTAM advising pilots of the hazard. On Wednesday, the spokesperson revealed that it was made aware by Russia of a planned missile launch. "We were made aware by the Russian Air Traffic Agency of a planned missile launch and associated potential hazard to international airspace within New Zealand's Oceanic Flight Information Region, or FIR, New Zealand's CAA wrote. The region is what CAA describes on its website as airspace over the high seas that New Zealand manages under the International Civil Aviation Organization's Regional Air Navigation Agreement. FAR includes a 30 million square kilometer area that is mostly international waters, according to New Zealand's Air Traffic Management Authority, spanning the South Pacific Ocean, the Southern Ocean, and the Tasman Sea. "We are in place a danger area and issued a NOTAM to alert aircraft operators to the potential hazard. This does not prevent aircraft from flying through the area. Operators make their decisions based on the information available," the agency continued. The flight was scheduled as a part of the U.S. Air Force's winter fly season, which transports researchers and necessary equipment to Antarctica before summer research season begins in the region. The aircraft is one flight that is scheduled annually to fly between Christchurch and both the U.S. and New Zealand's research bases in Antarctica. The story: McCarthy worried for GOP in midterms. What is the plan? Former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, said Wednesday he's worried about the Republican Party's chances to maintain control of Congress in November's midterms. "The midterms right now, I'm worried because the generic ballot is over 6 percentage points, so that's an advantage to the Democrats," McCarthy told Fox News's Dana Perino. "I'm worried that I'm not seeing the clear message from Republicans. What is the plan of why you should stay in the majority?" He also asked what Republicans have as an economic plan going into 2027 and what their latest successes have been as examples. McCarthy added that some states also give him cause for concern. "I'm going to watch Iowa. I think that governor's race there, Ashley Hinson, is the best Senate candidate in the country," he continued. I think she ends up winning, but we have 4 congressional seats. When I first came in, we only had 1 Republican. They're going to be some tough ones. Iowa has long trended red, but it could see Paralympic gold medalist and Iowa State Representative Josh Turek, Democrat, defeat Hinson. Decision Desk HQ, or DDHQ, forecasts Hinson with a 58% chance of winning the race compared to 42% for Turek. McCarthy then pointed to Pennsylvania, a swing state, as a place where Governor Josh Shapiro, Democrat, could have sway and who'll probably try to run the ticket up because he wants to run for president. Shapiro floated as a potential 2028 Democratic presidential contender, holds support from nearly 52% of voters in his reelection bid, while GOP opponent Stacey Garrity has nearly 36% backing, according to DDHQ's polling aggregate. The former House Speaker also sounded the alarm on Arizona after Representative Andy Biggs, Republican of Arizona, recently won his gubernatorial primary. Biggs, who is backed by President Trump, now faces a highly competitive race against incumbent Governor Katie Hobbs, Democrat. I'm worried about Arizona because I don't think the Republican nominee we have, Biggs, could cut across, get moderates and others, and we picked up seats from Democrats to win the majority, he continued. But if he underperforms, he could cost us Congress majority. Hobbs holds a slim lead over Biggs, 47% to 41%, DDHQ data shows. Recent polling from the Financial Times shows Democrats with a 6-point advantage on the economy over Republicans, with 44% of registered voters saying Democrats are better at handling the economy, compared with 39% who say the same about the GOP. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report in June also moved 7 House races toward Democrats. The report's House editor, Aaron Covey, said districts that were once considered relatively safe for Republicans look increasingly competitive. Some Senate Republicans have also said they see Trump as a growing political liability going into the midterms, pointing notably to his attacks on their ability to govern and the Iran war, as well as his pressure to pass the Save America Act before November. But some Democrats who already feel bullish about reclaiming the possibility, the possibly both chambers, are worried the party could trip over its own feet. Others said their optimism stems from the midterms being a referendum on Trump's second term. Will Democrats abandon Florida after Nixon win? Florida Democrats are worried National Party members are not to abandon the state in November after Democratic Socialist Angie Nixon defeated moderate Alex Vindman in a shocking upset in Tuesday's Democratic Senate primary. Shortly after Nixon's victory, Sabato's crystal ball moved the Florida Senate race from likely Republican to safe Republican. This was always going to be a heavy lift for Democrats, but following the primary, we are moving Florida's Senate race back to safe Republican, Sabato's crystal ball analysis read. The election handicapper noted the silver lining for Democrats is that donors might be less inclined to waste money on a state that Democrats have struggled to win in recent years. The party last won a federal statewide race in 2012. While it is impossible to precisely dictate where donors send money, those contributions would presumably be more likely to end up in more competitive states, the analysis added. Several Democratic strategists in Florida, however, warned of long-term implications of reallocating resources in interviews with Morning Report. Democratic strategist Steve Shale, who ran former President Obama's Florida operation for his 2008 campaign and was a senior advisor for the 2012 campaign, said it would be a mistake for Democrats to sleep on the state altogether. He noted more congressional seats are likely to shift south after the next census and that Democrats need Florida to win control of the House. It's hard for me to see a world where we get to 218 in the House with any regularity if we're not winning districts on the I-4 corridor in Florida and winning seats in Miami, and right now we're not, Shale said. He also warned of down-ballot implications of not investing in the state. I worry if Democrats don't think the top of the ticket's worth investing in, it makes it a lot harder for those folks running down the ballot to have kind of the baseline they need to win. Fernand Amandi, a Miami-based pollster and consultant whose firm also helped Obama's campaign win the state in 2008 and 2012, called Florida a state that you have to engage in if you ever hope to win the White House in the future again. Part of the reason that Donald Trump has won re-election twice, in my opinion, and why the MAGA movement has grown is because Florida was basically left all alone by the Democrats and disregarded, Amandi said. He also noted how important Florida is to the Make America Great Again movement. It's the head of the snake of the MAGA movement, where they literally all live, at least the main leaders of the party, Amandi added, and it's the laboratory for exporting MAGA concepts throughout the rest of the country in Florida. Sharon Wright Austin, a professor at the University of Florida who serves as vice president and president-elect of the National Conference of Black Political Scientists, said it would be the ultimate slap in the face for black female voters if national Democrats decide not to invest resources in the Senate race now that Nixon is the nominee. I think that it's going to really be a wake-up call and make people who are black Democrats really take some time to think about whether or not we should continue to support white Democrat candidates, she said, adding, or maybe we should just not continue to support the Democratic Party if they're not supporting us. Shale said he's skeptical national Democrats would have invested many resources in Florida, even if Vindman had won the primary. He said he has talked to fellow Democrats involved on the national level, and having been through a few of these rodeos with these guys, I don't believe establishment institutional Democratic world was going to be here. Shale noted that Democrats who hope to win statewide races in Florida will need to shrink the GOP turnout advantage, win independents by 20 to 25 points, and perform better among Republican voters than their GOP opponents do among Democrats. I think the math is hard for Angie, I do, but in all fairness, if you and I had the same conversation and Alex Vindman had won, I would be telling you the exact same thing, he said. Amandi said whether Nixon has a shot in November will depend on whether she distances herself from the Democratic Socialist label. Nixon officially joined the Democratic Socialists of America just a few weeks before her primary win. The problem with the DSA is that for all of their respectable economic populist positions, there are some not so much talked about elements of the DSA blanket platform that are not just problematic or unacceptable, they're disqualifying non-starters for huge swaths of the Florida electorate, Amandi said. And finally, it's Thursday, which means it's time for the weekly news quiz, one of the last major events on the calendar celebrating the country's 250th birthday, will take place this weekend with the Freedom 250 Grand Prix in Washington, D.C., so this week's quiz will cover some fast facts about IndyCar series coming to the nation's capital. Which of the following cities is not on the list of locations for this year's IndyCar series? Detroit, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, West Palm Beach. Why was the race extended from 125 laps to 147? Because Trump is the 47th president to create a 250-mile racetrack to go around the entire National Mall, so the track looks like the Great Seal of the U.S. Which of the following cabinet secretaries was involved, along with Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, in designing the course of the race? Marco Rubio, Doug Burgum, Scott Turner, Mark Wayne Mullen. Which of the following museums near the planned track revealed it studied the impact of the expected 185-mile-an-hour speeds of the race cars on its materials ahead of the race? National Gallery of Art, Air and Space Museum, National Archives, Museum of Natural History.